This is Metaphysical Universe, exploring science and spirituality with Dr. Douglas Kelly and Dr. Vicki Hunter.
And a good evening to you for Wednesday, May 22nd, 2013. My name is Dr. Doug Kelly, and I'm, of course, here with Dr. Vicki Hunter.
Good evening, Doug. Good to be here. You know, I'm glad you remembered the date, because I was just about going to grab my book and say, what day is it? What day is it?
Oh, I checked the calendar.
Ah, okay, there you go.
Oh, it's right in front of me. Anyway,
good to be here.
Yeah, good to have everybody with us. Got quite a few in the chat room. Good to have you with us listening to this live program. And if you're listening to the archive, we appreciate your time joining us as well. Metaphysical Universe is a weekly service and educational program of the Metaphysical Church of Humanistic Science. Our mission is to explore and empower the human spirit, as well as to explore science and spirituality. In addition to this weekly radio program, we also operate a metaphysics school where you can get your bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees in metaphysics, specializing in a variety of areas of your choice, such as spiritual counseling, life coaching, holistic healing, paranormal science, ufology, and several others. For more information, visit metaphysicsinstitute.org. If you're only interested in a standalone certificate course or certification course, you can visit our sister site at newageclass.com. You'll find several topics there, including ones on tarot, certified tarot card reader, and certified paranormal investigator, and there's some leadership courses and some other Reiki and so forth. So visit those for more information. Now, in a moment, we'll do our profession of beliefs. And after that, we, of course, have our special guest with us tonight, Dr. Bradford Neil Ivey, ufologist. We're going to be talking about some of the compelling cases over the years and kind of pick his brain on some of the different things in ufology as he sees them. Profession of beliefs. Am I doing this tonight, Vicki?
Well, I'll be happy to do them, Doug.
Well, if you're ready, then.
I'm ready. The spiritual philosophy of MCHS Church, of course, as everyone knows, is based on 9 principles of belief, which are, 1, as sentient and evolving human beings, we not only believe in practicing and living by the principle do no harm, but also in the principle of do right, thus enhancing the vibrational level of humanity. 2, we believe in the indomitable spirit power of the human spirit to ultimately triumph in the face of any dilemma. The answers we seek already exist within us. 3, we believe that we alone are responsible for and capable of solving human social problems, and believe the roots of those solutions lie in exploring, understanding, and empowering the human condition. 4, we embrace the differences that make all human beings unique, recognizing that we all come from star material and are, therefore, equal, irrespective of heritage, beliefs, gender, or gender preference. One planet, one race, one ancestry, and one destiny. 5, rather than a supreme being, we recognize and honor the divine energy that exists in all living things. 6, we believe the nature of the human being encompasses both the physical and spiritual aspect, and that human consciousness survives the death of the physical body in a coherent fashion. Thus, death opens a new chapter of life and conducts the individual into a higher state of existence. 7, we believe in self-acceptance, self-responsibility, and respect for free will, and that these 3 synergistically create the goal of self-completeness. 8, we believe in the value of practical education in metaphysics, metapsychology, and life skills as a means of empowering the human spirit and enhancing the human condition. We maintain an open, but grounded, mind to potential realities as yet undescribed by science. 9, we believe that discovering the true nature of consciousness and human existentialism will ultimately have a positive impact on human evolution and peaceful coexistence. Of course, for more information on these principles of belief, as well as MCHS Church, you can go to mchschurch.org.
Very good. So, again, we appreciate everybody joining us tonight in the chat room. You may need to refresh your chat room. If it's working for you properly, then don't refresh it. But I had to restart it a couple of times. Apparently, there's some technical stuff going on, but it seems to be fine now. We appreciate your participation in that. If you have questions tonight, you can certainly type them in the chat room. Or if you would like to call in, you can do that. Our Dr. John Hightower is back on the phone screening your calls, so you can call us up and ask a question, make a statement, share, you know, like the meaning of life with us and all that stuff if you want. The number there is on your screen. It's 714-459-3973. Go ahead, Vicki.
Well, I was just going to say, I didn't mean to interrupt there, Doug, but if we can just take a moment to acknowledge people throughout all of the planet right now are having struggles, and in particular closer to home in Oklahoma, you know, in light of the tornado the other day. Our hearts are with everyone. We send white lights, of course, to and if everyone there affected. And at the end of tonight's show, we're going to do a little meditation and magnify that energy 100-fold. So stay with us for that.
Yes. We, you know, our hearts go out to those folks who lost everything. Some lost their lives, some lost family members, and there was, of course, children taken as well, or, you know, who lost their lives. I don't want to say taken, but lost their lives. I'm kind of in the mode for what I'm about to say next. You know, there is something going around the net about something Pat Robertson said. He actually made some comments a year ago about the tornadoes in Oklahoma, and there's several stories that makes them appear that they were actually said this time around. But nevertheless, you know, he basically said if you pray more, you could still the winds, and just as Jesus did, so on and so forth. And what I want to put out there is, look, this stuff happens. It's nature. It's freak stuff. It is what it is. It's not good, but it just is what it is. Nobody did it. You know, there's no greater meaning to, you know, God needed more angels or any of that other crap that you hear. It just happens, and it's sad. And our hearts go out to those folks. So, you know, in your mind and your thoughts, send positive energy that way. Send happy thoughts to those folks. It might just do a little bit to lift their spirits. You know, we've talked about quantum entanglement in the past shows. You know, we've talked about collective consciousness, and it will help. So send positive thoughts their way.
Well, you know, some people pray to God. I pray to aliens, Doug.
Oh my God, you shouldn't
say.
I told you not to say that. Okay, she's off her meds. She's off her meds. We'll get those back. And
I keep hoping the aliens will beam down, please, please, at least take me for a ride.
Well, so let's speaking of aliens, let's get into it. You know, tonight we have with us Dr. Bradford Neil Ivey. He is a graduate of IMHS, and I don't probably have enough time to say a lot of good things about him because I have too many good things to say about him. He's grounded. He's down to earth. He knows his stuff. His dissertation on some of the compelling cases of with ufology and abduction research over the past several decades was excellent. He's also a recipient of the Akasha Scholars Award from IMHS, which is our highest award. And without any further ado, Dr. Brad, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, Dr. Kelly. I'm glad to be here. I heard you saying all those nice things about me, and I thought, gee, I'd like to meet this guy. And I thought, hey, he's talking about me. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you'll probably be looking forward to what you have to say then, huh? You'll be right on the edge of the seat of what you have to say.
Absolutely. And for Dr. Hunter, let me say, be careful what you wish for. You just might get it.
Oh, I've been waiting my whole life, Brad. It's just not my turn. I don't know. I'm not connected that way. I'm not so sure how I feel about abduction, by the way.
We'll get to that.
So I'm really looking forward to that part of our conversation tonight. So, but I'd be happy to go for a ride. I mean, why not?
Yeah.
I guess I would too. You know, it's easy to armchair these things. You say, well, if I saw a UFO, I wouldn't be afraid. But it would depend if it's night or day or if you're with somebody, a whole lot of things. So it's kind of up for grabs. What you
would actually I'm taking do. Doug.
Oh.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
There you go. Well, guys, let me start off, if I may.
Yes, please do. I was about to ask you a question, but you can just go ahead and start right off.
Okay, good. I don't know the audience we're speaking to. I like to.
They're humans. As far as we know, they're human. There could be a few others in there.
I like to start at the beginning of this thing because I don't know how much people know about ufology and abduction. But abduction is, according to some people, experts, so we say, UFOs are very old happenings. Way back in the Bible, people say we spoke about it. For example, in the book of Exodus, in chapter 21 and 22, it talks about Moses leading the children out of Egypt. And it says in there that they were guided in the day by a pillar of cloud and at night by a pillar of fire. And the Lord took not away that pillar of cloud or that pillar of fire to guide their footsteps. Now, one thing we need to keep in mind is that journey from Egypt to Canaan was 40 years. Now, 40 years is a pretty doggone long time for some kind of a light aberration to exist.
They took the long way.
Yes, they did. Now, I'm not saying for sure it was a UFO, but that's a dandy ball lightning that lasts 40 years.
So what you're really saying here is God was an alien.
I've been saying that.
Come on, that's my theory. I love that.
You know, someday I've got to do this again and give you some more things about some of the things I've heard about who are and who aren't aliens. that's for another time. But let's get into some of the early things here. And as far back as Columbus, he put Christopher Columbus, that is, in 1492. He put in one of his logs that he had seen some flying object just a few days before he landed close to the Americas. So this is not something that started, you know, a couple of years ago. This is something that's been ongoing as far as UFO historians are concerned. But the modern age of this, I guess, really started with the gentleman Ken Arnold back in 24th of June in 47. And he saw nine discs skipping along over by the Cascade Mountains in the state of Washington. And reporters pressed him for some kind of identifying characteristics. And he said, well, they skip across the atmosphere like you would skip saucers across water. Well, you can guess what happened from that. The press picked up on that and says, hey, they're flying saucers. And so since then, anything that's been known to fly, particularly if it looks like a saucer shape, has been colloquially known as a flying saucer. And that's one of the early modern cases. But the real important early case is Roswell, which is known as the Roswell crash or the Roswell incident. And we don't really know, I don't really know anyway, exactly when that happened. But I do know it wasn't really in Roswell. It was closer to Corona, which is some 70, 80 miles northwest of Roswell.
Hey, let me pause you for just a moment. There's a couple of points that I want to make, and then I want to ask you a question or get your thoughts. First of all, something I had meant to mention earlier is we're probably going to take this show to 60 minutes tonight.
Okay.
Just because we need a little more time. 15 minutes more should do us. And then this point on when did Roswell happen? I have read all kinds of dates from July 4th, 1947 to July 8th, even July 15th.
Mm-hmm.
Can you comment on that?
Well, now, the key person in this thing was the rancher out there, and he said that he saw it on the 14th of June. He saw debris out in the sheep ranch that he was a foreman of.
Wow, so that's a good 2 to 3 weeks prior to
14th of June. He was with his son at the time. He didn't come back and look for that stuff until, for some reason, on the 4th of July. And he collected some of this with his wife and daughter and son. And there was no reason why he collected it other than just to pick it up, I suppose. But it was the next day, the 5th of July, when he had heard from my neighbor that, hey, there are magazines that will pay $3,000 if you've got a piece of a flying saucer. So that's where those dates kind of come in. That same day, he went into town and told the sheriff he had some pieces of something that looked like perhaps a crashed airplane. So right away, the sheriff there contacted the Air Force Base. There, well, it wasn't an Air Force Base then. It was
Army
Airfield. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Later, just shortly later, it became Walker Air Force Base. But he contacted the folks there, and they sent Pete Marcel and a couple other people out, Jesse Marcel Jr., and they looked at this material.
Senior, you mean?
Well, actually, he was a junior. Jesse Marcel was a junior, the person. His son is the third.
Really? I never heard that.
From what I understand from reading.
He's always referred to as Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr.
Yeah.
I never heard he was a third.
Yeah, I have seen that also, but according to my papers here, he's known as Jesse Marcel Jr., who was the intelligence officer. So they collected this stuff and brought it in, and apparently he showed some to his son and his wife, and they looked this over, and right away the Colonel Blanchard says, well, hey, let's tell the press that we got a UFO out here. And they did. They put it in the paper. That showed up on the 6th of July. And right away then the colonel from, you know, the commanding colonel from Fort Worth says, hey, let's not be doing that. Let's get that out of there. So they retracted that statement. And then they got a hold of the rancher here, old Mac Brazel, yeah. Got a hold of old Mac Brazel and put the screws on him, so to speak, and made him retract the statement, basically on radio. And he retracted all he said, and he goes, oh, no, it was just a bunch of balsa wood and sticks and things of that nature. So he retracted that statement. And the story basically died at that point.
Right.
Now, had it not been for just a coincidence of Stanton Friedman, and most people who deal with UFOs know who Stanton Friedman is,
mm-hmm.
was doing some lecture stuff in Louisiana, and some guy says, hey, old Jesse Marcel is retired. He lives in Houma, Louisiana. You ought to get with this guy and ask him about what really happened at Roswell. And so he did sometime late in 78. And the story really began from that point.
Mm-hmm.
Stanton Friedman has been the driving force behind Roswell ever since and still is.
Absolutely.
Now, let me say something about Stanton Friedman right off here. There have been many people who try to discredit his research into documents that he has, I mean, scores of documents he has researched tirelessly from military sources and from witnesses and so on. One of their big complaints is, oh, the date stamps on these are not congruent with most date stamps. And I can tell you for sure, when I was at Fort Eustis, Virginia, back in, I want to say, 73 or 74, for a while, I was in charge of an AWOL deserter apprehension team, and I got reports in from all over the world with these people, and I can tell you for sure that there is no formula for a date for military secretaries.
Well,
I mean, it may be a Julian date. It may be the month first, the day
that's
first.
That's good to know. You're referring to the Magic 12 documents, right?
Oh, yeah, Matt, that and just tons more, which we won't have time to get into tonight. But well, if it means anything, I support his document research.
Well, that's good. Let's go back to Roswell for just a moment. We're going to keep things clipping along here.
Okay.
One of the things that's been occurring to me lately is, after reading your dissertation, and, of course, I've read Witness to Roswell and a bunch of other stuff. And, I mean, we've interviewed Stanton two or three times on a previous show, and But it really became clear to me that, you know, there's all these dates for when did this craft allegedly go down in Roswell. You know, was it July 4th? Was it 2 weeks prior? You know, and of course, there's also the claim that there were four alien bodies, three if you ask some, but one of them allegedly alive, right?
Yes, it was.
Okay, so that begs the question, man, if that thing crashed on June 14th, that little dude was out there for 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah,
right?
probably munching on cactus and whatever he could find. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if grays eat, but
yeah.
You know, but
now they did say that the dead bodies were highly decomposed in some of the readings I've had, so that would be pretty congruent with that.
Yeah.
I wasn't there, so I can't swear to that, but they said they were fairly
You told me you were there when we booked you for the show.
Well, I was almost there. 4 years later, I came along. and there's something more about this later I'll get into about the bodies.
Well, you might as well get into it now. We'll move on to other cases.
Let's leave old Stanton alone for a minute. Now, one of the big investigators in this, too, has been a fellow named Donald Schmidt. And from what I understand, he used to be a postman, you know, like a mailman, you know, years ago. And he did a lot of investigations with people back many years ago who were still alive at the time. And he had a lot of what are called deathbed confessions or admissions, not necessarily dying at that moment, but people who were imminently about to die. They were getting old and decrepit, and they didn't want to go to the grave with what they knew about this. And it's interesting because there were several that said the same thing. Yeah, we were here. We saw a live one walking. We saw a bunch of them underneath the stretcher. And everybody that he spoke to in this whole big article, and that was in Open Minds magazine, by the way, verified that there was a live alien. And they saw it walking around. And the military, when they knew certain people had seen this, they went to their homes or their place of business and threatened them with their life and their children's life if they reveal this anytime in their lifetime. And that's why there was not a whole lot of it said in the earlier years. That's why it basically died away. Now, one thing that interests me, after everybody talking about, oh, yeah, there was a live alien, what happened to that live alien? Well, there was a gentleman, I'm looking for his name here, my little notes here, who was part of the War College in 1948. And he had gone to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and they actually showed him this live alien. He and some other people of high rank showed him this little alien there and said it was someone that was captured or basically, you know, taken into custody at Roswell in 1947. And this person actually told this hours before he died to his two or three sons. It's actually on his deathbed. So a lot of people, I don't think, would like to have a big lie like that on their lips, you know, as they're dying about that. So it lends a lot of credence to it.
In your opinion, Roswell, real? Compelling?
Oh, yes, yes. I have no doubt after the compelling, you know, things I've read about it, just many, many things. I've talked to Stanton Friedman about it a little bit over the telephone and read a lot of his material. A lot of material from Ed Mitchell, who was an astronaut, who lived in Roswell, by the way. He lived there when this event happened. He was 17 years old. And he wrote about this considerably. And when he came back, after he was the sixth man on the moon. I don't know how many people know that, but he was the sixth man to walk the moon. And after the moonwalk, he had gone back to Roswell to, you know, to visit and lecture a little bit. And some of the old-timers who had worked for Roswell, and many of them did. It was a very open base, and many, many people worked at Roswell. It was a small town at the time. And they all told him essentially the same story. Hey, we were there. We collected material. We worked in the hospital. We did thus and such. There was four bodies. Three were dead. One was alive. Virtually everyone told him this. So he went to the Pentagon, ultimately, and asked people he knew who trusted him and he trusted, come on, guys, what's the story on this? And he was told that it was a real event, as people had told him. But, of course, they said, hey, you can't tell my name, and he never has. So you have to respect that. For that.
Does anybody know what happened to that alien?
I do not know.
No, I don't either.
movies have shown him as expiring after a while, you know, for various reasons. So
in the 50s, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I have no idea what happened to him. It depends on whose book you read. Now, that's one of my favorite things I tell people. Depending on whose book you read, this is what happens.
Yeah. All right, so we've got Roswell, obviously the probably most famous and one of the most compelling stories. And if people want to read more on it, there's gobs online. But Witness to Roswell by
Donald Schmidt.
Schmidt.
Yeah, Donald Schmidt.
And who's the other author?
Well, Stanton Friedman has written tons of stuff.
Well,
and the other one is Kevin Randall.
Yeah.
Kevin Randall has written some things. It's just huge. You can look on Barnes & Noble or Amazon, and you can just, literally hundreds of books on UFOs. And probably have something to do with Roswell.
So, but Witness to Roswell was one I read just a few years ago. It's a fairly recent book, and it's got lots and lots of good, kind of compelling stuff. So Roswell, pretty compelling account. Tell me, in your opinion, what other account would you say is up there for offering compelling evidence of the reality of UFOs visiting Earth?
Well, I'll tell you one that really rings a bell with me is an event that happened on November 17th, 1986, involving a Japanese Airlines flight 1628, which was a cargo 747. Now, very briefly, how I got interested in this, I was living at Newport News, Virginia at the time, which is close to a naval base where they have built all of the big aircraft carriers, the nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, which is important for our story here. And I was driving along, and Paul Harvey had his thing going with the news, and he was talking about a UFO that had happened recently. I don't know exactly what date this was. And I was listening to him, and what really caught my attention was that the UFO was about twice the size of an aircraft carrier. And being from Newport News, I knew exactly how big an aircraft carrier was. And then he further said, hey, some government agency has got photos of this thing. They have got information packets, et cetera, et cetera. And you can call this number and order this. And so I jotted that number down and threw it in the little well of my car for look at it later time. Some weeks and weeks later, I pulled it out and looked at it, and I called. And it was interesting because when I called, I got somebody from FAA in Maryland and told them my story. And he says, well, let me give you someone else who can help you. And so I was probably transferred six times. And the last time, which is interesting, the last time, for some reason, I want to think was in Colorado. And a very well-spoken, professional-sounding lady answered, quite happy and jolly and all. I told her my story. She goes, where did you hear this? So I repeat it again. And she said, well, I'm sorry, you have the wrong information. She says, we're not selling that packet. And boing, my ears poked up, and I says, does that mean you have the packet? She goes, well, I didn't say that. I says, well, madam, what you said was that you are not selling the packet, which indicates to me that you have the information in the packet, but you're not selling it. Is that a pretty fair assumption? She says, I have nothing else for you. And she hung up. And I still don't have that package, that's supposedly
available.
That's
a bummer.
So,
That's kind of strange, too, the government would be selling anything. But fill in the listeners a little bit on JAL flight 1628.
As I said, JAL 1628 was a flight from Paris, France to Tokyo, and they were to make a fuel stop in Anchorage, Alaska. And as they got into Alaskan airspace, they began to, the nice way of saying it, begin to see some strange aerial phenomena there. And they called the radar or Anchorage Air Force and said, hey, do we have any traffic at our altitude, which was about 33,000 feet? And they said, not at this time, but we'll check for you. And they called Elmendorf Air Force Base, which is linked up with NORAD, which is the North American Aerospace Defense Command, for those who don't know. And they had a co-system with them where they could do some serious tracking. And they did, in fact, see a large target around this guy. So Captain Terarucci, this is the captain's name of the aircraft, by the way, eventually reported a huge craft that looked like a shelled walnut. And by that, he meant with the shell still on it, not something, you know, kind of a weird term. And he said it was a silhouette approximately 1,000 feet wide with red lights on each side of it. And he said, through the radio, it was about the size of two aircraft carriers. So there was an exchange of information regarding radar with NORAD and with Anchorage and so on. And eventually they says, make a 360-degree wide turn to your right and see if this thing follows you. So they made this huge sweeping turn, and it indeed did follow them all the way through the turn. And as they straightened out, headed toward Anchorage, it was still there. Anchorage had dispatched a United Airlines to fly up closer to them to take a look at this. According to Captain Terarucci, when this airline got close, it departed at a very rapid rate. And, of course, that was it. He landed. Reports were made and all this. Long story short, what happened to Terarucci was he essentially got fired from the job. He had to fly a desk for a while. And Japan Airlines says, well, we don't think people who have hallucinations should be flying jet airplanes. So he was stationed with the desk for a while. He did get his job back after Richard Haynes intervened. And Richard Haynes, by the way, I believe he's retired now, but he was an engineer with NASA at the time, did a lot of UFO investigations. And he did a very thorough interview with Captain Terarucci. And he actually wrote to Japanese Airlines. He goes, hey, guys, this is not an isolated thing. This has happened many, many times to many, many pilots. And people are not hallucinating. They're not crazy. This really goes on. And so a lot of people don't know this, but he got his flying job back over that. So hats off to old Richard Haynes.
Yeah, absolutely. So this whole Japan Airlines incident near Alaska, the most compelling part of it is what about
the actual radar. Now, here's where this radar comes in. It wasn't until January of 87 until John Callahan got involved in this. Now, John Callahan is retired, but at that time, he was an accident investigations manager with the FAA in Washington, D.C. They called him and says, hey, we got this material, and the press is all over us, wants to know about this UFO thing. He says, hey, tell him it's under investigation. Send me all that junk so we can get rid of it. So they sent him the voice tapes and the radar, et cetera, to him. And FAA got in touch with President's scientific staff, however they do that. And they had a meeting at an FAA office. And there was three FBI, three CIAs, and a bunch of other people there. And Callahan presented his stuff to him. Hey, you know, they showed the clips of the radar and the statements, et cetera. Showed it three times. And finally, one of the CIA guys stood up and says, guys, we're taking all this stuff you got, and everyone here is sworn to secrecy. And so they basically ended the meeting. So as they were clearing out, Callahan said to one of the CIA guys, he says, well, what do you think this was? The guy says, well, it was a UFO. He says, we've never had anything good like this. Now we've got, you know, 30 minutes of information to look at. And this is the part that I really love. They took the information, all the evidence, they said they would. But they didn't ask if that was all the evidence. Man, it was at that time. But by and by, a couple months later, the FAA did their official report. We'll talk about that in a minute. And it was really half-baked. But when that got all done, there was a big, big bundle of stuff that came to Callahan. And he put it in a big old thick package and laid it on his desk and thought, well, the CIA will come by and collect this because they'll know about it. And it sat there for years on his desk until he retired. And they never asked for it. And this kills me. When he retired, of all places, he stuck it in his barn. He put this stuff in his barn. And it sat there for several more years until he felt, well, I think other people need to know about this. And so he started talking about the information. And there was a very good clip of this, by the way, on a video that was shown on TV. I want to say it was in 2009, called "I Know What I Saw," and James Fox was the producer of that, and I guess he directed most of it with Leslie Kane, who was also a journalist and avid UFO journalist on this.
So we got the radar tracking. We got obviously that the CIA, the FBI, and so forth. But there's also the captain of that airplane who had been flying for what, 30 years and had
29, I said. Mm-hmm.
Something like 30,000 hours, or how many hours did he have?
Oh, yeah, a bunch. Yeah, a whole bunch.
And so here's a guy that wasn't just him. It was his co-pilot and the navigator, too, right?
Yeah, yeah. They all got grounded. They said, hey, you guys, you know, guys
so
are nuts. So
why would you say something like that, knowing the culture in among these airlines? I mean, you don't say you see stuff like that because they'll ground you. And so that's, in my mind, that's another hugely compelling part. In fact, the most compelling for me is this captain's testimony when he had everything to lose.
Absolutely. And he knew he had everything to lose. It wasn't like he was guessing. He knew that this was going to put his head on the block. And he says, hey, I'm not lying about this because this happened, and why should I lie about it? And there's been we can't go into this tonight, but there's much more to this story, as Paul Harvey would say, much more to this story involving KC-10 fueling plane shortly after that. I mean, there's a whole lot more to this story. But as far as JAL, that's basically the end of the story there. And the best report I've seen about this, really good stuff, is in a book. It's a self-published book, from what I can tell, and I have it. It's by Russ Haywood. And it's called The End of Human Space. And you can find this online. I'll just put Russ Haywood, and they'll come up with his book. And it's not just about UFOs. It's about a whole lot of real quirky things that happen to people for various reasons. It's really interesting book. It's really, really neat. And it's Russ Haywood.
What's the title of the book again?
It is called The End of Human Space.
Okay. There's a question in the chat room. The question is, what do they want? Are there different species? Do you think there are the good guys and the not-so-good guys?
Boy, you know, I don't know that personally, but there are those who would tell you that there's 40-some-odd. I've got a printout here, not in front of me, but there are 40-some-odd species of these things. Some are blood and bone. I guess that's a good term to put it. Some are actually mechanical. Some are biomechanical, so they say. A lot of people now are thinking the grays are biomechanical, like drones type things, worker bees, as it were. I personally don't know that, but there's a whole lot of stuff out there, insect type things. And what do they want might be part of the question, and that has a whole great big who knows factor to it, you know.
Let's get into that. You know, I mean, obviously, you're well aware of the Betty Barney Hill story back in the 60s, which is probably one of the more compelling abduction accounts that there are, and the first really reported widely, back in the 60s. So,
absolutely,
got that going on. But let's talk about abductions. You know, where are you at on that? I mean, what's going on with that stuff?
Well, abductions is something that, now this, let me say, first of all, there are some that say abductions are recent. Now, I'll name a name, but this is not to derogate by any means. Please don't get me wrong. And if you're listening, Dr. Jacobs, I'm not derogating. Dr. Jacobs has said in one communication I've heard that he felt that abductions began sometime in the 1890s. He said at a conference 2 years ago that I attended that he believed they started in the late 1960s or 70s. Now, perhaps he just changed his mind on that, but I think he should have given a prelude to that, like, hey, I thought this at one time, but now I think this.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of one of the things that create a dilemma with these investigations, people just swapping their mind. And that is not to derogate Dr. Jacobs. I've met him a couple of times. I love Dr. Jacoby. He's a very humorous guy. I don't know if you've met him or not, but this guy ought to be a comedian. He's very entertaining. He really is.
Well, but, we interviewed him on our show a few years back.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah, I sure did. And but he's an entertaining guy to see in person. He really is. Now, there is another lady that I know quite well, Dolores Cannon. She is a long – now, Dolores is in her 80s, and she is a long-time hypnotist, you know, a deep somnolistic hypnotist, and she has brought out things that, boy, that you wouldn't believe. But anything – anyway, she says, from what her clients have said, these abductions have been going on since the beginning of time, essentially, that they have always been there. Some people swear they start in childhood, and if you're abducted, you've been abducted all your life. And actually, John Mack says that in one of his books, too, that I've read recently. John Mack has got a tremendous book. I mean, huge book about that. But you know something? That is a good book to read if you know something about abductions. If you don't, it's a little too stark to read because it's really shocking stuff in that book. But John Mack, as people may know, is pretty heavy duty. Well, he's passed away now. He got killed by a drunk driver, of all things, in England.
Interestingly.
Yeah, and he was a psychiatrist at the Harvard Medical School. So, I mean, that's mm-hmm. pretty good credentials. It wasn't like some fly-by-nighter there.
Mm-hmm.
But talking about abductions here, that goes back to Bible times, too, when Elijah was taken up to heaven in a whirlwind, so it says in the Bible, and it was a fiery chariot and a fiery fire, and he just went away, and it was witnessed by his son, Elisha, very similar name. So that goes back ways, too, if you want to refer to the Bible from that. But the first fully documented case, as we mentioned, was Betty and Barney Hill, and that was in New Hampshire near, it's a tourist place of all places called Indian Head in New Hampshire.
They were coming
back from a belated honeymoon trip. They'd been married for some time over a year, but their jobs kept them from getting away, and they had taken a vacation into Canada. And they're on their way home, and this event happened in the late night of September 19th, 1961, probably into the early morning hours of September 20, 1961. And it was in the White Mountains area of New Hampshire. And that's kind of important. We'll talk about that as a last note today, some of these coincidental things. And as they were driving home, Betty noticed an erratic star just kind of making zigzags across the sky. And she pointed it out to Barney, and they kind of watched it through the windshield. And she saw it go across the face of the moon. The moon wasn't full, but it was about 69% full at the time. Broken clouds, so they could see. So it started to get closer, and just a very odd thing. So Barney stopped, and he had binoculars, which they had taken on their trip to Niagara Falls and various places. And he got out to look at the doggone thing. And he said, okay, it's there. So they kept driving along and looking at through the windshield. And eventually they came around a curve, and here was this large, flat disc they described as about 80 feet in diameter, setting over a field to the left-hand side. So Barney stopped the car and got out with his binoculars again, and very quickly it shifted to the right. And Barney was watching with the binoculars, and according to him, all this is according to, now I wasn't there, he noticed there was rows of windows in this thing, and there were beings behind it. And he said what struck him was that they had this movement, very precise movement, as German soldiers. Now, I don't know what he really meant by that, but they had precision like German soldiers. And as he watched, they began to tip down and come toward him in this craft. And it extended some fins with red lights on the end. And Barney ran back to the car, absolutely hysterical, telling Betty that if we don't get out of here, we're going to be captured. And so they sped away, and they noticed the thing was right above their car following them. And they began to hear this half-beep, half-buzz sound like something was striking the trunk. And they kept driving, and as they came around another curve, they saw a sort of a roadblock there. And they went around the roadblock hoping to find someone out there that they could see. It was late at night. They thought, boy, we want to be around somebody, a restaurant or somebody. They didn't, so they kept driving and driving and driving until they got home. Interestingly enough, they got there at about 5:30 in the morning, and they thought, boy, that's really odd. Even with the couple little stops we made, we were sure we'd be here at 3:30 in the morning. So they had a couple hours they couldn't mm-hmm. account for. That caused a lot of dreams Betty had. It caused a lot of strange anxiety with Barney, which took a big toll on him through the years. And Betty actually reported this to Peace Air Force Base, which was in Portsmouth, where they live, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, on the 21st of September, 61. They came out and did a report for Blue Book, and subsequently, according to the book this was published in, which is Captured, written by Kathleen Marden and Stanton Friedman, that report was kind of jerked around and altered several times. So for our purposes, it's not really worth discussing because it's not really what happened in reality. I mentioned Kathleen Marden, by the way. I've met her several times. Nice lady. Kathleen is the niece of Betty Hill. She has all of the diaries and every scrap of material that Betty had collected over that 35, 36-year period from the time she saw the UFO until her death in 2004. And she is on the lecture circuit kind of giving the real account of what happened with Betty and Barney Hill as opposed to some of the more spectacular and incorrect stories that come out in magazines and other books and so on.
So, Brad, in your opinion, with the Betty and Barney Hill case, what do you think in a nutshell are some of the more compelling aspects of it?
The hypnosis sections, which came along with Barney's illness. He says, I need something to get this anxiety out of me. So he referred to hypnosis with a hypnotist named Benjamin Simon. And long story short, Betty was also in his sessions. And at one point in this session, she talked about when they were abducted, the leader, she referred to this head alien person as a leader. And the reason she called him a leader was that he could communicate with her. It was spoken in some weird language, but she heard it in English with a kind of a heavy foreign accent. She could understand him. Therefore, she called him the leader. He showed her at one point a map in there. And she says, well, where are you from on this map? And it was kind of funny, a little thing in a book. He says, well, where are you from? She goes, well, gee, I don't know. I don't know much about astronomy. He said, well, if you don't know where you are, it wouldn't do a heck of a lot of good for me to tell you where I'm from. And so he put the map away. But she looked at the map. She really absorbed what it was, a bunch of curved, straight lines, and spots all over. And that kind of stuck in her mind. And she wanted to keep something to prove she'd been there. So this leader says, you can have this little book. It's a plastic book with a bunch of weird symbols inside. So after they'd done the thing with her, needle in her navel and skin scrapings, etc., like most things are, they were leaving the ship, and one of the other crew members says, well, no, you can't have this book. And she says, well, he gave it to me. And so the leader says, hey, they've all got together and says, they don't want you to remember anything about this at all. So you're not going to remember it. And she says, sure, I'll remember this. He says, well, even if you do, it's going to be incongruent with what your husband says. And part will be right, part will be wrong, and people think you're nuts anyway, so to speak. So in her session, in her one of her last sessions with Dr. Simon, they had mentioned this map. This is the most compelling part of this. Long story, but it's the most compelling part. Dr. Simon says, in hypnosis, I want you to see this map in your mind. I want you to concentrate on this map and see what it is. And then I want you to go home. I want you to really relax and clear your mind. And I want you to draw this map exactly as you see it. And if you've read anything about Betty and Barney Hill, I know you've seen this map. A lot of people probably mm-hmm. have. Well, she drew the map, and that was in 1960, I want to say 1964, you know, April was her last session. Well, the map made a couple rounds here and there with some amateur astronomers. And eventually, in 69, a lady named Marjorie Fish, who was an amateur astronomer and an elementary school teacher, approached Betty and says, gee, I'm really intrigued with this map. I don't know a star system like that, but I'd kind of like to make some 3D models and see if I can come up with something. She said, sure. There was nothing that led her to a correct star system. It looked like Betty's. She was about to throw up her hands. And finally, a catalog got published, a Gliese catalog in 1972. And from that catalog, she saw a star system that she could build a 3D model that would exactly match, I mean exactly match, Betty's model, line for line, distance for distance, point for point. Now, are we to believe that some little old nobody lady from Portsmouth who was a welfare worker knows in advance about a celestial map that no one knew about for 11 years? Are we to believe that she could just create this great map drawing here and say, hey, here's a map star of something, and then it really happens? But that to me is extremely, extremely compelling, that she drew this map. Kathleen still has that map, and it's interesting that she still has that in her archives. And it, and of course, it's a little more amateurishly drawn than a regular astronomer would draw it, but I mean, it's, you overlay it and it's there. So it's a very compelling thing about, that was actually her provenance. The book they took away, but this map in her mind was the provenance. Sadly enough, Barney never lived to see this. He had tons of maybe related to the abduction, who knows, but he had tons of problems, and unfortunately he died in 1969 before Marjorie Fish even got involved with this, of complications of a stroke at 46 years old, young fella, and he never got to see the fruit of this. But that was a very compelling case to me. And
so we got about 7 minutes left, and we're taking a little longer on this tonight, folks. We're going to skip the 5-minute meditation this week and try to wrap some things up here in the little time we got remaining. So, Dr. Brad, you've been researching this stuff for a while. You've got a good handle on it. Mm-hmm. You talked about some compelling cases. You know, in your heart of hearts, I mean, what do you think is going on? What do you make of it? Of not only UFOs, but perhaps some of these potential abduction cases. What's your take on it?
Here's something I haven't revealed to you, or not a lot of people lately. A lot of people know this. I worked with the CIA one time, not for them, but with them from early in 72 until very late in 73. I was doing physical security with them, loaned to them from the Army. So, I can tell you, they do a lot of strange things that no one will ever, ever know about. They have money, unlimited budget. They have people that investigate weird things. They have special agents, whatever. Now, my thought on this is exactly what Ed Mitchell's thought is. I mean, and I had this before he even read his account. I have no doubt in my mind whatsoever that UFOs exist and that the government knows about them. Now, they have drones that can fly around with cameras on them, and they can see flies fornicating. I mean, literally.
So, that's funny.
I mean, this is so. Why in the world would they not know about UFOs flying around? I mean, that people see all over the world. Some are quite physical things. Some are spots in the sky. There's no way, none, the government's not going to know about this. People say, "Oh, where's the money come from?" Black ops, pork barrel. I mean, there's tons of money out there that these people get their hands on for this stuff. Officially, no. I don't think somebody says, hey, we're UFO investigators here, and we're going to go out and do this job like the IRS would do. I think they're all just people, undercover people who do it very surreptitiously with electronics and maybe disguise, like some of the movies say, as TV repair people. Who knows? But Absolutely. I believe in them wholeheartedly. I have seen one, and we don't have time for that tonight. I would love to come back sometime if there's more I'd like to tell you about this.
Well, you can come back anytime.
I'd love to tell you more about this. But I have seen my own UFO, and it wasn't a light in the sky. It was a massive, massive UFO. And let me say this real quickly for people who are interested. I have a website that is simply called www.euphoria, that's UFORIA.org. And there is a very good sketch that I made of this UFO and a very long synopsis of how I saw it, when I saw it. And in a couple days, I'm going to have a model of that UFO that was done to me by a lady. And it's such a good likeness. It stunned me when I saw it. It was just really freaky.
There's a question in the chat room. In your view, Dr. Bradford, what motivates the U.S. government to keep UFO encounters or knowledge away from the public?
I have nothing to substantiate this, but I believe in some way or other, and I can't really put my finger on this, that we as the government are involved with UFOs. And in what capacity, I don't know. But if they're here, and I believe they are, and the government knows it, I believe they're involved with them somehow. And in what capacity, I cannot say. It would be totally guesswork. But I believe they're here, and the government knows it, and they're working with them, and they just don't want people to know about it. It's controlled by a cabal, a very tight cabal, and I believe that wholeheartedly.
Could some of what humans get out of this is technology? Because we have advanced really fast, if you think 100 years.
Yeah, and you know, Ed Mitchell had a good point about that in Open Minds magazine, and that was in the June-July issue, by the way, of 2011. It's a very good interview. He spoke about technology from the time his grandparents went across the country in a covered wagon until he walked on the moon was only 100 years. That was astounding to hear that. It's like, oh, wow, you got to be kidding me. But the technology, the way that grows. Some people say we got this technology from aliens to us.
Philip Orso.
Oh, yeah. A lot of other things.
Fascinating stuff.
I believe abductions happen. Now, let me give you a couple good coincidences I've got from my research here. And I know you want to wrap up.
Yeah, we're about 2 minutes.
But
actually,
less. In the UFO thing in Roswell, the 509th bomb group was there, that had only one that had the atomic bomb. In 1961, they had moved to Pease Air Force Base in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, at the time the UFO thing happened. They were abducted in the White Mountains in New Hampshire. Travis Walton, which we haven't gotten to, was abducted in the White Mountains. The topographical forestry map in Arizona has the area where Travis was abducted. It's Area 51 on their topographical map.
Interesting coincidences.
Yeah, and as we all know, Area 51 is a place in Nevada where aliens and UFOs may or may not be, depending on whose book you read. So, kind of interesting coincidence.
Well, Dr. Brad, thanks so much for being with us. We'll have you back again. We can talk more about this stuff. We really appreciate the time you took sharing some of your views and some of these good stories and experiences, incidents, and so forth. You have good knowledge. Thanks so much.
Okay, you're very welcome. Thank you, Dr. Hunter. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Brad. And, you know, once again, if I can just say white lights, please, to all the people in Oklahoma who are affected by this tornado a couple of days ago, and sending you lots of love and lots of white lights. And good show tonight, Doug. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Well said, Dr. Hunter. Well said.
And we appreciate everybody, again, taking their time to listen to the program. If you like it, let other people know about it. If you'd like to learn more about metaphysics, visit metaphysicsinstitute.org. If you'd like to learn more about MCHS Church, visit mchschurch.org. We appreciate everybody in the chat room tonight, too. Good comments, good participation. Thanks so much. Thanks, John Hightower, for manning the phones. Good to have you back. Folks, until next week, listen, think, learn, grow, and live. Have a great night, great week.